Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. We're up to episode 57 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. It's the 10th of August. And returning from a little break is the Velvet Glove himself, Scott. Feeling refreshed?
I am feeling refreshed, thanks, Trevor. Yes, it was a good couple of weeks off.
Very good. Okay, so we've got another hodgepodge of different topics to get through tonight. And first cab off the rank, first Uber off the driveway. The census. Did you have a go last night? Did you try and fill in the census form?
No, I didn't. And the reason why I didn't have a go last night is because I found out if you do it on the line, you've got until the 23rd of September to do it.
Yes.
And myself and my flatmate have got to do it and all that sort of stuff. So we're going to do that this Sunday.
Yeah. I wish I was that
smart. We
will
be marking no religion when it comes to the religious question.
Yeah. Well, I've got six people
in
this house.
Did you get kicked out?
No, well, there's six people in this house. I sat down and went through the whole thing, which took quite a while when you've got six people. You know, I've got a couple of homestay students here. One's from China, one's from South Australia. There's a bit of detail to fill in there. I've got my grandmother who I look after. Like, it wasn't stock standard. And it took a while. Went for the submit button. And, of course, like everybody else, discovered I'd just wasted an hour of my life. So... which was disappointing because I had six people all lined up with no religion ticked, Scott. So
six, even your mother, hey?
Yeah, even convinced her. Keen listeners will know that that was a bit of an issue, but I discussed it with her and she was prepared to accept that. So anyway, Scott, we'll have another go at that later on when the system's back up. But one of the things that came out was from the Humanist Society, and they produced an article, might have been slightly older one, but basically telling their members that if you wrote down in the other column or the other section under religion, humanist, then that would be okay. You would still be classified as no religion. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, until then. So I guess it makes sense. But so if people in the other column choose some obvious non-religion sort of descriptions, then they'll get counted in the no religion section. So so that was interesting. So humanist was one of those, but they actually produced a table of various terms that could be used, which will come under the no religion category. And I thought some of these were interesting, Scott, because some of these might well apply to you and I. So there were some classic ones there that you would understand, like anarchist, anti-religion, apostate, heathen, indifferent, infidel, no religion, non-believer, none in particular, secularist. You could write down secularist and you will be... in the no religion category.
Classified as having no religion.
Yeah. Mm. Zilch is another one, which would get you there. A couple were there where I've heard of the term, but I've never really known what it meant. But I thought I'd quickly look it up. One I hadn't heard before was, have you heard of a Calathumpian?
No, I never heard of a Calathumpian. No.
A non-judgmental way to describe a religion or philosophy in its infancy.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, which I would have thought... probably shouldn't be in the no religion category. But anyway, that was one. An iconoclast. Have you heard of that?
No, I never heard of an iconoclast.
An iconoclast, a person who...
I've heard the word before, but I couldn't tell you what it means.
Yeah, I'm the same. A person who attacks or criticises cherished beliefs or institutions.
Okay.
A destroyer of images used in religious worship in particular. Second one. So I could classify you as an iconoclast, Scott. A person who attacks or criticises cherished beliefs or institutions. There you go.
Well, I suppose, you know, we do have an iconoclastic podcast once a week, don't we?
We do, yep. A nihilist, N-I-H-I-L-I-S-T. The belief that all values are baseless and nothing can be known or communicated. It is often associated with extreme pessimism and a radical skepticism that condemns existence. A true nihilist would believe in nothing, have no loyalties and no purpose, other than perhaps an impulse to destroy. Well, that's not us, but that's...
No, it's not us, but still in all, it's... It started out all right, didn't it?
Mm. Well, I reckon that's a view that some religious people have about non-religious secular people, that they believe in nothing, have no loyalties and no purpose other than perhaps an impulse to destroy, like, because we're clearly lacking any moral guidance from a holy book. Like, you know, I think the non some very religious would consider the non-religious to be nihilists.
I'd say so, yes.
Mm. You a Unitarian. So this was a non-theistic Unitarian. There's all sorts of descriptions of Unitarians, but I think it's getting to a person is free to search for his or own personal truth on issues such as existence, nature, and meaning of life, blah, blah, blah. A couple more. An existentialist, a philosophy that emphasizes individual existence, freedom, and choice. It is the view that humans define their own meaning in life and try to make rational decisions despite existing in an irrational universe. It might be us. And
possibly us.
Lastly, a positivist, a theory stating that positive knowledge is based on natural phenomena and their properties and relations. So, Scott, I'll link to the article there. And, dear listener, if you're a Calathumpian, iconoclast, nihilist, Unitarian, existentialist, you could write that in the other column and you'll still be considered no religion, apparently.
Well, that's true. And, yeah, I encourage all our listeners to put themselves down as no religion.
Yeah, that might be just simpler.
Exactly.
Well, if somebody just accuses you of being a nihilist, at least you'll now know what it means.
You know what it means, and you can hit back and say, "No, I'm not a nihilist. I don't believe that everything should be destroyed."
Yeah. Mm. Scott, have you been watching any of the Olympics?
Little bits and pieces of it. I haven't been religiously following it or anything like that.
Right.
I was surprised when the Australian swimmer got up and made all those comments about his Chinese compatriot. And he had a valid point and that sort of stuff, but still, and all, you'd think that he'd managed to keep a lid on it. But anyway, yeah.
I think this is one of those cases where the people in authority are not doing enough, so the people at the front line are complaining and saying their piece. So, fair enough from my point of view, if you want to say that. But
I suppose, yeah.
Little bit of trivia knowledge for our listeners is that athletes who are religious may say a little extra prayer. Who they would possibly direct to Saint Sebastian, the patron saint of athletes.
Yes.
You see a number of people crossing themselves at the Olympics. So the question is, just so our listeners are fully up to date, who was Saint Sebastian? Existed in the third century.
Sebastian.
Lived in the area around Milan in Italy and was an early Christian. And he was deeply upset by the Emperor Diocletian's persecution of Christians. So he joined the Roman army to help them from within. But he was discovered, and they tied him to a stake and proceeded to shoot arrows at him till he ended up looking like a pincushion, apparently.
Mm.
Anyway, he was left for dead. A woman came and recovered him that night, found him still alive, and nursed him back to health. And you would think at that point that they all lived happily ever after, right?
Well, apparently not. Yes.
Not for poor Saint Sebastian. Because once he recovered, he approached Diocletian in the streets of Rome and complained about his cruelty to Christians, at which point the emperor ordered his guards to beat Sebastian with clubs and dump his body in a sewer where he died. So that was Saint Sebastian, patron saint of athletes.
And he got known patron saint of athletes because he recovered from these wounds, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, showing strength, I guess, was the sort of thing. Mm. You could, if you wanted more information, Scott, you could ask Ray McKenna, president of Catholic Athletes for Christ.
You know, it's so ridiculous, isn't it? You can't just be a Catholic. You've got to be a member of Catholic Athletes for Christ and all that sort of stuff.
Yep. There is an organisation for everything. Catholic Athletes for Christ. Ray McKenna is the president. You know what that means, Scott?
Well, we're going to have a secular athletes for secularism.
That's so. Right. I think secular athletes for humanism, something like that.
Yeah.
There's another organisation duly created to provide a counterpoint to the Catholic Athletes for Christ.
Yes, yes, very true.
One final point. Rio de Janeiro. Actually, well, Rio de Janeiro is January River, but the full name of the city is Saint Sebastian of the January River. So, São Sebastião do Rio de Janeiro. So,
oh, really?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you would think that that big statue with the outstretched arms that stands above the harbour, that's Saint Sebastian?
No, it's actually Jesus Christ.
It's Christ the Redeemer, yeah. But anyway, you'll never look at the, you know, Rio de Janeiro the same again.
No, well, I mean, it's one of those countries I've always wanted to go and see and that sort of stuff, but the crime that's being reported puts me off.
That's right, yeah. Yes, yeah. All manner of crime there. So
yeah, absolutely.
You'd want to be well looked after when you're there.
Yeah, I think so.
Brief article about a bit of a altercation at a bus.
The Lebanese athletes refused to share a bus with the Israeli team to get them to Friday's Rio Olympics opening ceremony. I found that really strange that they did that, but Israel and Lebanon aren't at war, are they?
Oh, I don't know what their relationship is, but basically everybody in the Middle East outside of Israel pretty much hates Israel, don't they? Isn't that formula to use?
I mean, I think Egypt has actually signed a peace accord with them, but that's about it. But everyone else outside of Israel hates them.
Yes.
Anyway, it is what it is. It's a hell of a mess.
The Lebanese team were on the bus waiting to head to the stadium, and the Israeli athletes tried to get on board to share the bus and were told they couldn't get on. So that's not showing the Olympic spirit.
No, it's not, and it is a hell of a mess. And you know, even there was a situation that was reported yesterday or this morning or something like that about South Koreans and North Koreans taking selfies together.
Oh, that's nice.
And you know, and that is in the spirit of the Olympics. Even though those two countries are still technically at war, you know, it was very good that the two Olympics team managed to set aside their national differences and pose for a selfie.
Yeah. I guess the key point there, Scott, is that their differences aren't based on religion so much, are they? I mean, that's when you get serious. You
know? They're not based on religion, that's true. Yeah.
If it's not a religious difference, then you're only just pretending, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm. Closer to home, John Menadue's blog had a couple of things for us this week. One was about private health insurance, and he's had a few different good little blog posts about private health insurance. And this article, he says that the private health insurance industry continues to make invalid assumptions about private health care. The first is that governments are intrinsically high cost and bureaucratic, and that the private sector is more efficient. And he says this is patently not true. The least efficient health service in the world, the US, is based on private health insurance. The most efficient healthcare service in the world is the National Health Service in Britain, which is based on a single public provider. And here was an interesting one. In 2014, Ramsay Health, the principal beneficiary of subsidised private health insurance, paid its CEO $31 million, the highest remuneration in the country, and much higher than even the CEOs of banks. Like, what an obscene amount to pay somebody.
Well, $31 million is a ridiculous... It's a ridiculous salary package for a guy to get.
Yep.
It's even more offensive that the company that he works for, let's face it, a large chunk of the insurance premiums that they sell come out of the public purse. You know, it's crazy yep. that he would then turn around and say to his boss, I need $31 million. You know, yep. I find that utterly offensive.
You know, it's just the classic, this will be the line that Scott Morrison will run over the next 3 years, you know, more competition, more players competing against each other will lead to more efficient outcomes. Yet, yeah, you know,
that's not true, is it? I mean, he said it there beautifully. He said the most efficient health service in the world is the National Health Service in Britain, which is based on a single public funder.
Yep.
And he's right. You know, it is the most efficient health service in the world. Yep. It's absolutely maddening that you've got this situation where we are pumping money, we're pumping taxpayers' money into propping up private health insurers.
Yep.
You know, we really should be charging a higher rate of Medicare. We should be doing away with private health insurance in its entirety, and we should go to a single government-funded medical service provider.
Yep. He says there's little point in saving, you know, a dollar in taxes if instead you're paying $1.10 or $1.50 to private insurers, which is how it works.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Mm. And when you've got a CEO getting paid $31 million, you can't say that there's efficiencies happening there.
No, there clearly can't be. If your CEO is getting $31 million, you've got the CFO is probably going to be getting $15 or $20
million,
the CIO, all that sort of stuff. It's just going to cascade.
Mm. That's private health insurance. And just briefly, on John Menadue's blog... So there's a right wing, there's a think tank, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, who's heavily involved and got links with the Defence Department, and all of a sudden they're starting to say, maybe we need nuclear powered submarines instead of conventionally powered. So
I don't think it's anything. I don't think it's anything out of the blue. I think they've been listening to our podcast.
I think that's right. So,
you know, and they've taken what you've said on board and they've looked into it and said, yeah, nukes are the way to go.
Yeah. See, and I've stolen it all from John Menadue's blog. I think they've probably more likely been reading his blog. But but that's where we're headed. I'll make a prediction, Scott. You know, within 20 years' time, the decision, if we're still going for big subs like that, they'll be nuclear-powered, or they'll be wanting to make them nuclear-powered.
Well, in 20 years' time, isn't that when this next generation of subs are due to be rolled out?
Yeah, so at some point they're going to have to switch to nuclear propulsion for them. If you're going to have a big sub, it's going to have to be nuclear-powered.
Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I just wish they'd have, you know, half a dozen small subs instead. But anyway.
Mm.
We're not going to say much about Donald Trump in this episode, but...
I did notice you did like him last couple episodes.
Didn't yes. Little history, folks, on the recent presidents of the United States. We had George Bush Sr., this is back from 89. He was there for 4 years. Bill Clinton for 8. George W. Bush for 8 years. We'll have had Obama for 8. And let's assume Hillary gets in and she, let's say she makes it for 2 terms and gets 8 years. That would mean that out of 36 years, 28 of those years, the president has come from 2 families in the United States.
Yeah, that's worrying, isn't it?
The system is broken. Like, that is a highly likely event that it's either going to be 24 out of 36 or 28 out of 36, if that's a huge percentage of those years, and just two families providing the president of the United States. The system.
Yeah, and it would have been worse had Jeb Bush won the nomination, because then it would have come down to a fight between which family legacy do you want to go with? Do you want to go with the Bush dynasty or do you want to go with the Clinton dynasty?
Yes. It would have guaranteed at least 4 years to one of those two families. So
exactly.
I saw something. I didn't read it closely because I didn't know whether it was... I just didn't have time. But whether Michelle Obama was thinking of going for the Senate somewhere. Like, I don't know. I only saw it briefly. I didn't get a chance to read. I think I just saw a headline somewhere. But
well, if she did run for the Senate, then that would put her in the same sort of career track that Hillary was on, where she was in the Senate. Then she became Secretary of State, and then she became presidential nominee.
Exactly. I mean, becoming President of the United States is just the family business for these.
It's certainly looking like that, isn't it? It's worrying that, and they shouldn't have this situation. The primaries and all that sort of stuff are designed to break that system down, but they're overcoming all that, and they're running off with the system. It's crazy.
Mm. So anyway, that's that. Now, Scott, I found an article which is one of my favourite of recent times. I quite like this one, which is titled "Science Explains Why America is Going Off the Rails." And it introduces a word called... Now, I'm probably going to get the pronunciation wrong. It's spelled A-S-A-B-I-Y-A, which could be Asabiya or Asabia. I'm going to go for Asabiya. But,
I had no idea how to pronounce it, but anyway,
It's an Arabic word meaning group solidarity. In a community with Asabiya, everyone is willing to contribute without being coerced. In the US, people were willing to invest so heavily in the nation because, for the most part, each of us felt committed to the country, and more importantly, we were confident that everyone else felt committed too. So that's the central notion that this article is going to explore, is this idea of a common purpose where people work together and cooperate. And, okay, so you need to sort of have that in the back of your head. And it's a little bit lengthy, this article. Mm. But I think it's really worth exploring. It talks about the US context, and it certainly can transfer to Australia. So there'll be a fair bit of quoting here, but... I really, really think it's worthwhile, particularly, Scott, because we mentioned in the past, like, one of the problems with secularism, atheism, anti-theism is we're sort of knocking religions, but they do perform a role in a tribal sense of getting people together, and people enjoy the social aspect of religion, and we're not replacing it with anything.
And I did read that, and that was the first thing that came into my mind was... We're not offering anything that was replacing that. You know, we're just out mocking it.
Yeah.
It's
important. So, okay, so this article, feel free to interrupt whenever. But so, why are politics in the US so messed up? Why are we in genuine danger of electing Donald Trump? A growing number of scientists think that religious rituals and beliefs are a kind of social glue that encourages people to cooperate and commit to social norms and expectations. The data on religion and cooperation will continue rolling in for decades, but at this point, the empirical case is pretty clear. Religion actually does play a critical role in promoting cooperation within societies. Above all, religion seems to generate parochial altruism. That is, believers generally help in-group members only. Newspapers remind us daily that religion's track record at establishing ties between groups isn't so hot. So religion's very good at getting cooperation by believers within the group. In other words, religion is socially adaptive but objectively amoral. It helps humans survive by helping groups function and by defining group boundaries so that people know who to cooperate with. I think that's fair enough.
It is fair enough, yeah.
It sort of helps organise
people. I didn't find
people.
Anything in that I disagreed with. So, it made perfect sense.
So I agree with that so far. Now, what it says is, in this article, that the United States is a bit unusual because it was such a hodgepodge of different groups that came together in the United States that didn't have a particular shared religion, for starters, or philosophy. But what they did was they created a new sort of American patriotism and civic pride, created symbols such as the flag, etc., and forged a new shared identity based on being American, and saying that that was the group that they created, which had a real sense of the collective group about it, where people were willing to commit and do things for the country because they felt confident that the rest of the country, everyone else in the country, was prepared to do the same, like mutual sort of cooperation in that sense.
Well, it was cooperation. It was cooperation, wasn't it?
Mm. So the example is a bit like a school project. If your fellow members are slackers, you get resentful and you cut back on how much you're prepared to do. But if your team members are go get them, then you lift your game and match them as well. So it's that sort of theory, in a sense. So the United States had a broad civic culture. And this article says that that broad civic culture is a form of acerbia, basically saying that's now in decline in the USA. There's not that shared commonality. So a coastal liberal couldn't stand to be associated with an unfashionable rural people. And, the South are very different to the North. And I've said this before, like, in America, somebody in, San Francisco is so different to somebody in the Deep South that they may as well be from two different countries. Like, they really are different people. Mm. And you've also got inequality, which is also making distinctions between people in terms of rich and poor. And what it's saying is that it no longer feels like everyone is on the same team working together. So people withdraw from social consensus and become less willing to sacrifice for the collective. The collective pool starts to shrink. That all makes sense so far?
It makes sense.
It's people sort of retreating back to their sort of individual groups. The other thing about inequality is people going to sort of Ivy League universities are encouraged by their educators to be individualistic, extremely analytical, resistant to social obligations, and to disrupt and innovate, as opposed to the working class who are encouraged to basically toe the line and do what you're told because that's how manual work gets done efficiently. So that was interesting aside there. But so it comes to the conclusion that our shared emotional commitment to the collective has been replaced by more narrow interests, and different factions of society are pitted against each other. It's the perfect petri culture for a populist nativist demagogue like Donald Trump to arise and wrest power from the dissent and the from the decent and the educated. I think that's a really interesting sort of overall look at society, that when everybody is around the same level, kind of you look at everybody and you think, yep, they're doing about the same as me, I can count on that guy to sort of be like me, think the same way. The collective works a lot more efficiently, and when it breaks down into very different groups, it's hard for people to commit to the collective in that situation if they don't feel that everyone else is pulling in the same direction.
And it's bang on the money, isn't it?
Mm.
It makes the point in there that with inequality, that Abyssinia has been in retreat, and it's getting... It is really... I'm loath to say it, but I think you're right. We do tend to follow the United States a decade or two behind them. And, you know, the way our government conducts itself and, you know, the going back to the private health insurance, Scott Morrison saying that, you know, we just got to get more competition and blah, 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 blah. It won't be long before we are just like the Yanks.
Yep. And, I mean, well, Pauline Hanson is the case of this. I mean, she's getting the disgruntled and the disenfranchised. I mean, you know, people in Gladstone, for example, or that sort of small manufacturing, the people who are losing jobs because we just don't offer that type of work anymore. And realistically, it's very hard for them to, you know, they can't all be baristas. You know, if we're going to drop segments of the society, then those segments are going to say, well, you know, they're going to break away from that collective feeling. So we're going to break down into small groups, and those groups are going to be fighting against each other, basically.
And I think that's right. Mm. It is a concern the way it's gone, because you do have a situation where you've got people throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. You've got people automatically assuming that all free trade deals are bad and so on and so forth. You know, there are free trade deals and then there are free trade deals. Mm. But, you know, it's crazy that we are moving down that road of getting rid of all our free trade deals to placate the minority who are feeling disaffected.
Well,
yes.
I don't know. Are we getting rid of free trade deals?
Well, we're not, but, you know, the TPP is going to fall flat on its backside.
Yeah, I'm happy about that.
Yeah, I know. And, yeah, you know, like I said, there's free trade deals and there's free trade deals. Mm. The TPP was a bad free trade deal. Yep. You know, it could have been better, but for whatever reason, we went in to negotiate with the Americans and we took the usual position saying, yeah, whatever Washington wants, Washington gets. Yep. You know, it's crazy. But the other free trade deals that were on the table that were working quite well, they are all brought into question now.
Yeah, well, you know, if we're going to discard an industry on the scrap heap and say the motor vehicle industry or whatever, then we just can't discard the people on the scrap heap. Otherwise, we're just
gonna... right. And I do think that, you know, there's a article coming up where we talk about... wealth doesn't trickle down, it just goes offshore.
Mm.
I think we've got to replace those industries with, I don't know, some sort of government largesse to keep people working. But, you know, or we go back to subsidising the industries. You know, we instead of throwing the billions at the submarine industry in South Australia, we could have spent a tiny fraction of that amount of money and still had an auto industry left behind.
That's right. You know? Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, to the very wealthy, they might think, well, I'm going to be okay, my kid's going to be okay. But just look a few generations down the track. I mean, whatever you're doing, whatever service you're providing or widgets you're selling, you need people to sell them too. And if you've got a real lot of poor people with no money, then they can't buy your widgets and your business, you know, starts to fail. So, you know, I just say you can't be too greedy, and our society is in danger of falling apart, you know, long term down the track if we just abandon groups. And people will feel it and they'll start voting that way, as they are in America. It's these people who feel they've been dropped on the scrap heap who are the ones who are lining up with Trump. And it's the same group in Australia. Maybe a bit of anti-Islam sentiment in the Pauline Hanson category thrown in there. But there's also that sort of economic sort of scrap heap type group as well, I think.
Agreed. And I don't think you can I don't think you can put Hanson just into the xenophobic Islamophobic category. You can't throw her in there and say that's all she is.
No, it's more
she's
than
a
that.
Lot more than that.
Mm.
And some of it she has a point on.
Mm.
I'm not prepared to vote for her. I didn't vote for her at all in the Senate. I would like to put that out there right now, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't vote for her at all. But she does have a point. And I do think that...
Well, she's got a group of people who are angry and disaffected. Unfortunately, she doesn't have a point to of any solution, but she's just a figurehead for them to sort of... A bit like Trump, like, you know, that the poor and disenfranchised in America are turning to Trump. And, I mean, he's the last person who's going to help them. Like,
exactly. He's not going to help them at all.
Yeah.
And he's one of the guys that's benefited greatly from the move away from domestic manufacture in the United States.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, he's got them conned. And, you know, Pauline Hanson, I don't know that she's had much to say in terms of solutions, but people just feel sick of the major parties disenfranchised, and they'll go for a name that they recognise that's a bit of a protest vote, I think, proposed any solutions.
It's just a pity we couldn't get more of them to protest vote in our way, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, that's true. Scott... bit of religion.
It wouldn't be a podcast without it, would it?
No, it wouldn't be. Syrian Catholic leader challenges claims Islam is non-violent. So,
yeah, I found it a little bit hard going, but I had to read it a second time. But he's hard to disagree with, isn't he?
He's basically saying Christians in the Middle East are an endangered species.
Well, he is, yeah, and he's right like that. I mean, like, there was, 5% of the Iraqi population were Christian, now 1% of the Iraqi population's Christian.
Yep.
You know, it's, you know, that's Iraq, but, you know, Syria's gone through the same thing.
Yep.
And, you know, where ISIS takes over, they don't tolerate anyone else unless you're a member of the Islamic faith.
Yep.
So, you know, it is pretty awful what has happened.
Yep.
It's, where was it? No, I can't find it. He did make one point in there that I underlined. No, I've lost it. Anyway, it is worth the read, you know, and so I encourage people to go and read it. But
So he's saying Christians are in danger of disappearing, and, you know, thanks for your help in the area, like a genuine thanks, but... You guys realise that, you know, Christianity is nearly wiped out in the Middle East, is what he's saying. He makes the point.
Well, you're going to end up with nothing in the area except Muslims on one side and a Jewish rump on the other.
Yeah. He says in Saudi Arabia, they allow Christian foreigners to enter the country as temporary workers. So there's 1.2 million Christians living there, most of whom are from the Philippines. And apparently, those Christians are not allowed to practice their faith openly, and items belonging to religions other than Islam are prohibited. So no Bibles, crucifixes, or statues of the Virgin Mary are allowed in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, that's really not very nice at all, you know. And, you know, here is Saudi Arabia, and yet, you know, they do that, and they do it quite legally and legitimately, but they're on the international mob that deals with human rights.
Yes, yep. Mm. Which kind of leads into a report. Now, this is one, how Islam progressively takes over countries.
And I was a little bit uncomfortable reading this.
This is uncomfortable, and before we even say anything about it, the guy who wrote it, let's get him out the way first of all, Dr. Peter Hammond.
Where did he get his PhD from?
Well, he's a missionary who has pioneered evangelical outreaches in the war zones of Mozambique, Angola, and Sudan. Founder and director of Frontline Fellowship. He's a real Bible basher. Born in Cape Town, converted to Christ in 1977, worked in Scripture Union, served in South African Defence Force and studied at the Baptist Theological College. So he's a real evangelical Christian right-wing nutter.
Nutter, yeah.
Anyway, a friend of mine, Tony, sent me a link from this thing that he'd done, which was basically saying that when Islam or the number of Muslims in a population is quite low, then, well, when they're under 2%, then they're seen as peace-loving minority and as and not a threat to other citizens. And basically, he just goes through a few different bands of percentages, from 2 to 5%, and then from 5 to 10, and 10 to 20, and blah blah, and basically pointing out countries that are in those bands, and then saying at that point, you know, Islam then progresses to have more influence over the society and starts all sorts of things. So I think, Scott, I'll leave that one to people to look at in terms of his theory on the way that Islam takes a foothold in a country, and as its foothold gets better, its influence increases, and he gives various examples.
Yeah. It is kind of hard to argue with him because he does ramp it up. Mm. He goes through and he lists countries that have got 90% and so on and so forth.
Mm.
And he's right. There is violence and that sort of stuff that follows them.
Mm.
But this is the part that I found disturbing. Today, there are 1.5 billion Muslims who make up 22% of the world's population, he observes. But their birth rate dwarfs the rates of Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, and other believers. Muslims will exceed 50% of the world's population by the end of this century. I don't see that happening. I mean, like, I'm pretty sure that that when you follow the birth habits of Muslims in developed countries, that they might be slightly higher in that, you know, they have 3, perhaps 4 children each, but they no longer have 8 or 9, you know?
I don't know. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, you know, when they live here in Australia, for example, they've got a reasonable living standard and all that sort of stuff, so they take into account birth control.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen stuff in the past projected population growth of various religions and where it'll be at a certain point. So, Scott, let's just pause for a moment, and I'm going to look this up.
Sure.
Hang on. So, the Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove, and the 12th Man are all members of the Secular Party. There may be other contributors to the show who are also members. That does not mean that every opinion given on this show is policy of the Secular Party. To find out what is policy, go to the website of the Secular Party. And while you're there, think about joining and signing up, because we need more secularists in this world. Thanks. Dear listener, we just paused our podcast to do a quick bit of research. So the guy on this article has said that Muslims will exceed 50% of the world population by the end of this century. And we've done a quick Google search and ended up with the Pew Research site, which says that by 2100, Muslims will have overtaken Christians. Muslims will be 34.9 and Christians 33.8. So, look, he's wrong on that score, so he could well be wrong about the other bands that he's listed there in terms of what happens when populations reach a certain point. But, look, it's up to you whether you read that one or not. It's thought-provoking anyway.
It was thought-provoking. It was uncomfortable reading it, but it was thought-provoking.
Yeah. You
know? And anyway, I find it bizarre that you've got these predictions of what's going to happen in the future when they completely ignore the fact that it's only 1 or 2 generations after they first arrive in a country that they become just like the rest of the country. So,
yeah.
You know, I find it bizarre.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He, in his thing, said that as the Muslim population reaches 2 to 5%, they begin to recruit from ethnic minorities and disaffected groups within prisons and street gangs. This is happening in, and he lists the United Kingdom, where it's 2.7%. He also says from 5% on, they exercise an inordinate influence in proportion to their percentage of the population. Now, in his defence, I guess we would say, the next article, Scott, kind of confirms what he says, because in the UK, in Luton, a public swimming pool, has now got segregated swimming sessions due to demands from the local Muslim population.
Yeah, and, you know, clearly that's wrong. You know, it's... I find it incredible that Britain has, you know, kowtowed to 2.7% of their population in this manner. I mean, Britain should have held a line and said, no, this is a public-provided swimming pool. We don't have gender segregation in public-provided swimming pools.
Exactly.
That's what they should have done.
They should have.
But instead, they should have. Instead, they've bowed to them and said, yes, all right, you can go for it.
Yes.
I find that ridiculous. I find it really, really ridiculous that they did that.
I mean, we would think that couldn't happen in this country, that the local swimming pool will have a segregated swimming times based on sex. But people would have said that in the UK 20 years ago. Like, they would have thought, you've got to be kidding. That would never happen. Surely.
Well, you know, clearly it has happened. I find it incredible that... anyway, I find it ridiculous that they've given in to them and they've given in to the demands. I know Luton has a larger population of Muslims than what the average British place does.
Yep.
But it still can't be any higher than 10 or 20% of the population.
Even if it's 100%, like... The whole point is...
Yeah, agreed. Even if it's 100% of the population, it's still publicly funded, it's still publicly provided, it's gender neutral.
It's totally unnecessary, and it's demeaning to everybody.
It is, yeah.
Some quotes from the article. An imam has claimed men and women, regardless of their faith, prefer segregated swimming pools in the wake of a row. Oh,
what a load of nonsense.
Over a male-only swim session at Luton Pool.
That is a complete load of nonsense.
Ajmal Masroor told Talk Radio that women prefer a segregated pool where they can enjoy themselves without being an object of desire. His remarks came after Luton's Inspire Sports Village began holding men-only swimming sessions, banning the opposite genders from mixing on Friday evenings. The taxpayer-funded swimming pool sparked outrage after introducing weekly men-only sessions. Mr. Masroor said that the demand for segregated pools is extremely high from people of faith and no faith. Men, despite paying a lower fee and having earlier use of the facilities, are entitled to use the main 50-metre competition pool, while women are restricted to only the 20-metre community pool.
So women are restricted to only the 20-metre community pool?
Yes. A lady who used to... No, he was interviewed, and the lady said, I wouldn't be allowed to go to that pool on a Friday night in Luton if I lived locally, simply because some men, on religious reasons, have some issue with seeing my body. She continued, I find that as a Briton offensive, because this is bringing in a culture that demeans women.
And she's hit the nail right on the head there.
Mm.
You know, it is bringing in a culture that does demean women. I find it incredible that Britain... has allowed that to happen.
Mm. Mr. Masroor responded by calling the interviewer ignorant and said, even men feel objectified as sexual objects during mixed swimming sessions.
Oh, for God's sake.
He said that if Christians wanted to hold a Christian-only session, he would have no problem with that. Ah, Scott, this...
It's absolutely... mind-numbingly stupid that he would say something like that. You know, that he, if they want to have a Christian-only session, we're then going to have, you know, atheists-only, all that sort of stuff. Madness.
UKIP MP said, this kind of behaviour, pandering to one group, harms community relations and creates tension. It's created tension just with me in this room, and I'm not even there.
Exactly. Like, that's, and we're not even there,
God, that makes you angry. Let's hope it doesn't happen here, Scott.
Well, you know, we...
I mean, is there a Lakemba...
Sure it doesn't happen there, you know.
Public pool?
Say again?
Is there a Lakemba public pool, you know, like in areas where we've got a large Muslim population? Is there any chance that that could happen?
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. You know, it could happen there, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Scott, brief article, basically saying wealth doesn't trickle down, it just floods offshore. And it's a fairly old article, but it basically... A guy, very well credentialed, did a study, and the amount of money that is potentially offshore is mind-boggling. So if you're into 21 trillion, perhaps, the super rich have taken out and hidden offshore from the various countries.
It really is sickening when you sit down and you read that. Because, you know, there was the point that he raised that he said, you know, that there was a country, Nigeria. Was it Nigeria?
Yeah, could have been. Would have fixed the country's...
Would have fixed the country's debt problem, you know.
The amount of money that the...
That the super rich have siphoned out of the country. And that's not a country that can afford to have money sent offshore, you know.
No, so that's that one. Another article from Quillet, which is where Majid Nawaz works, and titled Liberalism's Great Challenge, How Can We Critique Ideas While Protecting People? And I mainly wanted to mention it because there's just a great line in here. I mean, you've heard the line, nobody wants to mention the elephant in the room, and in this paragraph it says... but desperately avoided acknowledging the prayer mat in the room, which I think is what happens all the time, that people refuse to acknowledge the prayer mat in the room. The left recognises that millions and millions of Muslims are decent people and so insists that Islam itself is benign, while the right sees Islamic teachings as pernicious and so treats Muslims... and all people who look remotely Middle Eastern, as if they're all essentially terrorists, paraphrasing there. On both sides, feelings win arguments when logic and evidence fail. That offends me, is trotted out and is meant to be the end of the conversation. One thing here, talking about those abortion clinic attacks that happen in the US, when the abortion clinic attack happened, all my liberal friends were very confident that the attack was partly inspired by Christian beliefs about life and abortion, and they were right. When the Orlando attack happened and the guy pledged allegiance to ISIS, my liberal friends said it has nothing to do with Islam. That happens.
Yeah, and you know, the liberals, the small L liberals, are going to have to deal with this. They are going to have to take a long, hard look at Islam, and they're going to have to say to themselves whether or not they actually agree with. Well, no, they're going to have to. You know, ISIS is the Islamic State in Syria.
Yes.
You know, they wouldn't call themselves the Islamic State if they had nothing to do with Islam.
Well,
you know,
everything they do is to do with Islam. I mean, they're
exactly,
They're towing, you know, the Islamic text to the letter. So it's impossible to say that they're not compliant with Islam. I've been reading some books, Scott. I've just finished The Sirah, which is a political biography of Muhammad. And that's been eye-opening. And also in this sort of same topic from a guy called Bill Warner, He's sort of got a book with summarising various arguments and stuff. But one of the points he makes out is that Muhammad became a prophet of Allah, there were 360 religions in Mecca. The Arabs were a very tolerant people, and there had never been a religious war in Arabia until Muhammad arrived.
Is that right?
360 religions until he turned up and then wiped them all out. So anyway, in a future episode, I'm going to go through the Sirah and the highlights or lowlights of that, but that's really worth reading. Scott, briefly, well, maybe not briefly, Bill Leak had a cartoon, and in the cartoon, well, it all comes about because of the Aboriginal kid in that detention centre in the Northern Territory who's trussed up like he was an inmate at Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib or whatever. Like, it's a pretty horrific scene. And he produced a comic where there was a policeman sort of handing over an Aboriginal kid to an Aboriginal father who's got a can of beer and saying, you'll have to sit down and talk to your son about personal responsibility. And the Aboriginal father says, yeah, righto, what's his name then? And Bill Leak has been set upon by everybody over that cartoon. You're game enough to wade into this one, Scott?
Look, I mean, I thought the cartoon was in poor taste.
Yes.
And when I first read it and that sort of stuff, I read the hoo-ha around it. So I went looking for the cartoon, found it online, and I didn't smile or anything like that. I thought to myself, well, that's in poor taste.
Mm.
And then just put it on the back burner and thought nothing of it. And then it wouldn't go away for days. You know, the story just continued to evolve and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
On the Drum, just recently they had a... because, you know, 18C is back on the agenda now, even though it's never going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And they're talking about that... they're talking about that... they were talking about that particular cartoon.
Right.
In relation to 18C.
Yes.
And the point that I would like to make is that 18C, it clearly can't be prosecuted under 18C, because otherwise Bill Leak would have found himself in the dock by now.
Yep.
And even if it could have been prosecuted under 18C, I don't think it would have been necessary to prosecute under 18C, because, you know, the commentariat, that the people have already made a judgment on it, and they've all said it's in poor taste and it should go. So I tend to think that things that are in poor taste are going to be held up in poor taste, and they're going to be ridiculed and so on and so forth. So I would I'd let it I still have not backed away from wanting 18C repealed.
Yeah.
What would you like to say, Trevor?
I'm a bit sympathetic for Bill Leak on this one.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, depends what he's trying to say. Like, I reckon people are looking at the kid in, you know, a juvenile detention centre and going, what is a kid doing in that situation? How did it get to that point? Whatever.
Yeah.
And I think he's just making the point, well, it's not like we can send these kids back home. Or, you know, that's, you know, we know that there are totally dysfunctional Aboriginal communities. I mean, we've just had in Aurukun the school evacuated because they couldn't guarantee the safety of the teachers in the town. So I just think he's making a valid... If the point is, you know, how did that kid end up there? Well, because we've got some dysfunctional Aboriginal communities, that's a fair comment. It is. And I mean, if there was... if it was a white kid, white trailer trash or something like that, you could have run the same cartoon in a similar way if you wanted to, but it wasn't in this case. So... I've got some sympathy for him if he's pointing out what is the case, that kids are in that situation because of totally dysfunctional home life where there's no future for them going back there, and they're the reason they've ended up where they are. And if that's the point he's making, I think it's a fair enough point.
It's hard to know what the point he was actually making. I mean, it's. I think you're probably reading a fair bit into that. I don't think Bill Leake is overtly racist or anything like that. But
well, he said there in the cartoon.
It would have been better if he hadn't have published it.
In the cartoon, it says, you know, the policeman's handing the kid over to the father, saying, "You will have to sit down and talk to your son about personal responsibility." And
yeah.
You know,
and then the father then says, "Yeah, righto, what's his name then?"
Yeah, which is basically like, "Well, that's not going to work." So,
yeah.
I'm a bit sympathetic for him, and
oh, look, I'm a bit sympathetic for him too. But I think that his second cartoon I thought was good. This bloke's been telling the truth, and he thinks it's funny. Let me at him, and it's it's a guy in a Twitter t-shirt and that sort of stuff with a club with a nail in it, and he's got a noose there ready to go. So it's the Twitterati lynch mob.
Yes.
You know, ready to go for him. And I think that's right in that, you know, social media had torn him apart and so on and so forth. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, what was it that Principal Skinner said in The Simpsons once? He said, "There is no justice like the mob justice." Right.
That's good.
So I think we should let the mob deal with it rather than having it dealt with in the courts.
Yeah. All right, Scott. Well, I reckon that's episode 57. We must be coming up to time on that. So, dear listener, we will bid you farewell, and we will catch up with you next week for episode 58.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Bye now.
Bye. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, "Hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to." And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.